Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. My name is Dan Safarik. This is episode 115, Homegrown Cities.
I'm Greg Lindsay, and our guests this week are Matias Echnove and Rahul Srivastava, co-founders of the studio Herbs, as well as authors of Homegrown Cities, Reclaiming the Metropolis for its Users. Get my singular and plurals backed up there. I want to delve into that in a moment there. The use of users is very interesting, gentlemen. But first, obviously, I just want to thank you both for being on the show. Been a longtime fan. I can't believe we're finally having you on Unfrozen. For listeners, I first became aware of their work, I think, from their Strelka ebook, The Slum Outside, which was a great line. I think it's a great setup for their practice. Because if I recall correctly, the title of that came from being in Dharavi, where Herbs, the studio, is based, and asking residents, where is the slum? And they always said, well, the slum's over there. This is a middle-class neighborhood. We are good middle-class urban dwellers. And this idea that, you know, that from the West or from the North, looking down upon informal settlements as slums, like the inhabitants themselves never see that. So in any case, we're glad to have them on today. Very discerning listeners will see some great linkages, I think, from our conversation today with Emergent Tokyo back in, I don't know, Dan, season one, season two. Obviously, there's going to be some great links here. So, gentlemen, welcome to Unfrozen.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Yes.
Well, I imagine, I don't know if it's presumptive to think that this is a bit of a capstone work for the two of you and over a decade of really thinking about informal settlements. But yeah, I would love to know the genesis of the book itself after you've been working this long. What sort of motivated you to write this reverso? And then I would like you to unpack the use of users in the title versus residents, inhabitants. Those of us in the urbanist discourse like wrestle over what to call people because, of course, citizens implies privileges and things, but users, you just end up with that, I think, is really interesting. So I don't know. I'll let the two of you to choose how to answer, but maybe I'll call on Matias first.
Okay, I'll answer to your first question about, the book, and then I'll let Rahul answer about the users. This was a really, really nice thing that happened to us. Verso in London came to us about 7-8 years ago and asked us to write a book and then and gave us a contract for it and, you know, gave us even an advance, and we're like, okay, great, you know, let's do it. But we're also practitioners, very busy, just getting going with our projects, and so it took us a very, very long time. Although Rahul and I have always been writing a lot and we keep on writing a lot, it was a completely different thing to bring it all together into one book that could let readers have an understanding of the journey, and also give entry points into some of the concepts and methodologies that we've deployed all over all these years. So we're very happy to just finish it. We just finished writing it really, in September, and the book has been out just now, like for the past month or so. So it's been quite a journey.
And with regards to your second question, Greg, the idea of users really for us was a way of getting out of the narrative of reducing all people who occupy urban space, live in urban spaces, work in urban spaces, from simply having one role. You know, they, when you say inhabitants, it gives a certain kind of description of what people do, but it's not enough, because inhabitants doesn't, the word inhabitant doesn't resonate with activities like work or even recreation, or it does not take it for granted that these activities are part and parcel of it. So for us, the word users, first of all, also gives a sense of agency. There's an active principle. It is not a sort of, it has a sort of a resonance to it, which works closer to the way we visualize people who live and work and do many things in cities. So that's one reason why we prefer users.
And I just want to say also that there's a little story to this, because we initially, our tagline was the user's generated city. And so we always had this idea, that there's always been some kind of interesting parallel between tech and the way it's developing, and on the whole, crowdsourcing phenomenon, and the way some neighborhoods that we've really been interested in have been developing over the years.
Great. Well, as a way for the, as a means for the two of you to get into really talk about sort of the themes of the book, I would love your overall take. Again, having really been at this as practitioners and writers for well over a decade, I mean, Slum Outside is at least a dozen years old at this point. I'm curious your take on the overall discourse about informal settlements and where this goes. Because I was just thinking about this. There was, you know, again, more than a decade ago, you had the Stuart Brands and the Ed Glazers of the world arguing that, you know, slums are the most entrepreneurial places on earth and will be the saviors of the city. And then you had, of course, intense pushback from Mike Davis, Planet of Slums, arguing that, which we see now, obviously, with China and its economy, that would, you know, perhaps deprive global South cities of the means of economic ascent. So I'm curious, you know, as the homegrown city arrives right now, where do you see it fitting into this discourse and how informal settlements are seen?
I can start. I think, you know, one thing which is really important for us is that although a lot of our observations are grounded in our experience of Dharavi, where we've been running an office for the past 15 years, Dharavi in Mumbai, which is considered to be one of the largest slums in Asia. And we really had to kind of push back against this way of understanding the neighborhood, because it's so much more than that. We're not saying that there are no conditions which deserve the calling of the denomination of slum inside Dharavi. There are some very difficult conditions. There are some very difficult spaces within it, but there's so much more. And homegrown for us really tried to kind of say, what are the active principles in a neighborhood like Dharavi that we can recognize and value? And then we also clearly saw that there is a bunch of things that we can learn from Dharavi, which are also relevant to other places. And the homegrown is really not just another way of saying slum. It's not a politically correct way of saying slum. It's not also another way of saying informal. It's something else altogether. We're saying that the homegrown is a prevalent urban condition everywhere, including in Europe. It's even there in the US, North America. We just have to recognize it. And why it's there everywhere? Because it's a product of a very, very clear propensity of people to shape their own habitat. And where it's not there, where it's missing, it's because it's been suppressed very actively. It's being suppressed very actively. So we're just trying to say, how do we live with this notion that habitats also actually, you know, do grow and do develop along with the users and their intents and the projects and activities.
Yeah, I'll just interject to say I've always loved one of you in your practice, your photo composites. They've always really demonstrated that to me of putting side by side Dharavi with, I mean, Naples. There are other various cities here to actually show how this process, that all these places became something. But Rahul, please.
Yeah, no. I was just going to add the whole thing of capital. You know, like today, for example, we do have a vision of urban development which is linked very strongly to the capacity to have or generate huge capital investment. And almost everywhere, the moment we talk about urban development or talk about creating urban spaces, it is somehow contingent on being able to raise large volumes of capital, which automatically means a large scaled up version of what urban spaces are visualized as. And for us, we felt that this is, of course, not something which is so easy to organize and manage. And for a lot of people, this also makes them omit the capacity which is inherent to many neighborhoods and settlements around the world to generate capital incrementally over a period of time, just by giving them a certain foundation on which they can exist. And this ability for us to look at capital which can grow incrementally in a patient way is also part of our narrative of the homegrown. And it is something which is ignored. And in fact, today we have almost forgotten that a lot of social, economic, urban development at one point of time did take place with a very different understanding of time and what people themselves could contribute, how they could contribute. Now it's all about technocratic expertise and technocratic expertise linked to financial speculation. And this is a very, very reductive way of looking at urban spaces.
Yeah, it is also fascinating that, you know, Dharavi is, of course, seen as the world's probably most famous slum, Slumdog Millionaire, et cetera, there from that film. But it is also, of course, perhaps the world's, most lucrative potential urban redevelopment project on the planet as well, given its location in the core of Mumbai. That dichotomy is obviously not a coincidence. Dan's being patient, but while I'm asking you to play my favorite hits from your works, can you talk a bit about the Toolhouse? Because I thought about the two of you a lot during the pandemic. It's been a while since we last chatted, but yeah, that moment where everyone in the global north was basically incorporating all of their activities in life into a single structure. I thought of the Toolhouse from The Slum Outside, and your unpacking of this typology is the really resonant form of places like Dharavi. So could you talk a bit about that and other sort of typologies of the homemade city that you think are relevant and interesting that play out?
Right. Well, you know, so the tool house is again connected to what we were discussing earlier, which is that incremental, you know, use of capital, that the home itself becomes a source of generating capital. People who live in those spaces can realize that they can double the value of the space where they live by multiplying different kinds of uses. So in terms of convenience, what the COVID really taught us is that, well, yes, we don't have to define working and living in such discrete and categorical ways, and that there's also convenience. And more importantly, you know, we suddenly had the entry of Zoom in our lives during the COVID, you know, and it was literally it was very dramatic because it was a software and it was an app which was available and which suddenly sort of amplified. And it made us understand that yes, spaces are malleable, and that we can play around with them a little more. However, there's also a backlash post COVID. You know, I mean, there's also a very strong desire of people to talk about separating spaces even more. So there's also both sides. On one hand, people saw the value of tool house conditions. On the other hand, there was also a sense of an awareness that our houses are not really designed, because that, you know, the fact is that most homes were designed in the last 20th century from the point of view of simply being spaces of living alone. So the challenges of that also emerged. For us, Dharavi and places, you know, and other homegrown settlements are examples of flexibility in architecture and space, which allows us to create spaces which are more directly connected to specific forms of activities which we do. And so the tool house became very visible at a certain point of time, but it also exposed the limitations of hard structures in the way we've been creating our urban spaces. But what we would like to argue is that by again talking about the relevance of multiple uses and not reducing you know, urban space or urbanness as having just one or two characteristics, is to simply show that, you know, that flexibility is possible, and that flexibility is the root of many things. I mean, we need to be flexible in the way we work, the way we live. And this, you know, this quality has become completely out of our present consciousness, because almost everything has become rigid. And this rigidity is part of the problem.
I think maybe just to build on this, for us, it's really about how do people use whatever resources they have at hand to get by. And sometimes it's a workshop space which is converted into a dormitory, because, you know, that's the only way in which people can actually afford to stay in the city. Sometimes it's a garage which is transformed into a startup. You know, it's just basically it flies against the idea of zoning in a rigid way. And when you start, when you need something, where it's really triggered by need, necessity. So when you actually need a space to start something and you don't have any other space than your garage or your living room or your bedroom, this is where you start. And this is how you we're just saying that, you know, this type of incentive, this type of transformation of space is something that that must be allowed, because it corresponds to very, very basic propensity of people to actually use resources in whatever way they can to get by or to get creative and to move ahead in their lives.
Yeah, again, it's fascinating that Silicon Valley literally got started in a garage, which is now, of course, a museum as well. And we have Stuart Brand, How Buildings Learn, that part of this is part of this vaunted discourse of urban reuse. And then the other part is, you know, seen as this condition that needs to be cured.
And it's right. Fascinating.
But Dan, go ahead.
Well, one of the words that pops up, not too frequently, but at occasionally moments that were quite resonant with me, was this idea of, in talking mostly about Dharavi and its relationship to Mumbai and capital dynamics there, was Shanghaization, or the concern about basically, a neighborhood being wiped away in favor of you know, much more capital-driven developments. That resonated with me because I lived in for 2 years in Shanghai. I lived in the kind of the what used to be called the French Concession, and it was famous for having all these little laneways that were full of exactly the kind of commerce that you're talking about. And there was an active campaign, and I fear that it probably has gone further since I left, to demolish most of this type of neighborhood and replace it with kind of, yeah, faceless sort of high-rise developments that had only vestiges of, you know, cultural artifacts left. But that sort of, it was very striking to me about, for all the rhetoric about, you know, the Chinese Communist Party and the idea of collectivization and all this, just how enterprising people were in these small businesses. You could walk down the street and get everything that you needed. You had to go to 5 or 6 different places and knock on some doors and run into some unexpected things, but that was kind of the fun of it. I mean, there was so much urban vitality. What do you think drives, you know, there seems to be this impulse. I guess my greater point is that it seems that there's an impulse to try to drive out this type of enterprise, regardless of what kind of government system you're operating under. What is the impulse that makes, you know, governments and in the service of capital want to do away with these disorderly places that are actually quite enterprising and have a very thriving economy? It's just, is it that it's all under the table and it's not taxable? Like, why are they so intent on getting rid of this type of place?
We have a chapter in the book which is titled "Mess is More," and this is really what it's about. You know, it's about the way some neighborhoods are perceived because of the way they look, more than anything else. You know, they are seen to be, for a country like China or India, neighborhoods like this seem to be reminiscent of previous time, where those countries were qualified as third world, you know, by the West. And this seems to be leftovers from that era. This is the way they perceived. And we're really saying it doesn't have to be perceived that way, because actually many of those neighborhoods have modernized, adapted from within, and become economic hubs, you know, places which are completely embedded with the new technology as well, and that keep on evolving all the time. So they also represent the present and potentially an alternative future. And one city that we love to refer to, because it's a city which has not followed the path of Mumbai today and Shanghai, you know, a few years back also, is Tokyo. Tokyo, I mean, of course, now the landscape is changing even there, but for the longest time, and still now, it has kept those low-rise, high-density, mixed-use neighborhoods very much alive, and has not seen it as a problem even to retrofit infrastructure, has not seen it as a problem to, let's say, bring an entire formal taxation system to these neighborhoods. You know, it's not rocket science. It's what we've been saying for years. You know, we can work with this fabric. It's a bit more complex. But ultimately, nothing is more complex for inhabitants and the people who live in those neighborhoods to have to recreate a life, you know, in a low grade high rise building somewhere in the suburb, where they're being pushed away. So yeah, I mean, I think it's really just a matter of the order that we wish to see as you know, urban planners, investors, you know, politicians, maybe the media, and the incapacity of understanding that within what looks like a mess is actually a very functioning system that definitely needs some support and help. But a type of help which is not destructive, which is constructive and helps the evolution of those neighborhoods.
Well, I would say James C. Scott has entered the chat, it feels like, here. When you're talking about this, this is very much a discussion about legibility and that. And I'm curious, your politics center, how they've evolved on this too, because, you know, Scott was a bit of an anarchist. He mostly studied rural tribes who were removed from power. So, yeah, I mean, I'm curious, like, do you see these as sort of anarchic systems that will evolve on their own? Because you could also argue that they deserve more capital and investment as well, too. I'm curious how you see that play out. Because, again, when you mentioned Tokyo, and we discussed this in the Emergent Tokyo episode too, like one of the reasons it was able to rebuild so quickly after the war is because they had clear land title, which of course has always been difficult in informal settlements. You have the Hernando de Sotos of the world arguing that we should give land title to the dwellers here. So I'm curious how you play out this issue of like individual rights and property and versus self-emergent systems. I don't know if those are two separate questions together, but curious your thoughts. But Rahul, if you want to take a step.
The thing is that there are usually a composite set of elements operating why certain histories emerge in a certain specific way. So yes, in the case of Tokyo, you know, there was a combination of factors, post-war, what Matthias, talked about in the book as well. We discussed that in great detail. There's a whole chapter dedicated to Tokyo. On the other hand, and which individual property rights linked also to cultural elements, you know, for example, graveyards being, the way in which people would connect to families and ancestral spirits, all of these things shape the way in which cities, in the way in which neighborhoods grew. And this is true of, you know, of many places. In India, caste plays a very invisible structure in the way in which people accept and tolerate a certain messiness. As long as certain services are provided, you know, you will often see that in Mumbai, the expression of certain kinds of settlements, as long as they are service providers and they're close to middle class and upper middle class homes, are allowed, and that's not seen as does not seem to be a problem. You know, there's a lot of acceptance of messiness also, but which is not always based on progressive values. You know, it's also there are a number of contrary forces at work. In different places, you know, for example, when you, in the US, segregation was the norm. You know, it was very important to segregate, to separate, to keep distances. And that became part and parcel of policies as well. So culture and invisible structures, which are linked to social imaginaries, all of these also play in the way in which people look at the idea of disorder. James Scott, as an anthropologist, was also rooted in a certain way of looking at colonial state and the relationship between more autonomous societies and communities. He was talking about peasants. A lot of his work is really on peasant societies. And the anarchic element is, of course, very strongly linked to a lot of politics, which looks at even urban discontent or urban resistance from that lens. However, the examples which we talk about and what you were also talking about earlier, Daniel, which is that the messiness of entrepreneurship, you know, which is also something which people have an ambiguous relationship to. You know, it's on one hand, it is accepted. On the other hand, it is also something which does not represent future cities, you know. And so then it has to be clean, sanitized. And often the mess comes along with literal problems of hygiene, for example. I mean, Paris in the 19th century was literally the perfect example of the transformation which happened here, using same categories, slums, dirty, unhygienic, so on and so forth. So I would say that there is no one argument, and there are no one reason why certain expressions, certain ways of being emerge. However, one can very confidently say one thing, which is the fact that the idea of anarchy is obviously not about disorder. You know, the whole idea of anarchic expression is linked to internal modes of order, which is what our book also talks about, that the mess hides real order, and the order is self-governed. It is often it generates from impulses within. And this is something which also translates into other concepts. We talk about it at the concept of adhocracy, for example, which is seen to be a slightly different take on an anti-bureaucratic mindset. So an anti-bureaucratic mindset is sometimes also predicated on the idea of flexibility and adaptiveness, which is what adhocracy talks about as a concept. So, for us, in fact, one of the biggest learnings has been that go beyond the superficial and see what exists behind the appearance. And the appearance often can be deceptive. And one can say this very confidently on the other side of the spectrum also, you know, extremely clean and sanitized urban spaces have a lot of hidden disorders at so many levels, from psychological to much more dysfunctional in terms of class, etc. So for us, that is the most important thing, that there are, you know, you have to go beyond appearances. It's important to understand that urban spaces do express themselves in surprising ways. And there are a number of different factors, from cultural to political, economic. They cannot be reduced to one formula, for sure.
I think one of the most striking observations in the book is that, you know, not only do the authorities consider these places unhygienic, you know, disorderly, let's replace it with something that appears more hygienic and is more friendly to investor capital, to say it in shorthand. But they also actively prevent people from making incremental improvements to their own infrastructure, or they try to. So you end up having, you know, pipes being laid across streets and haphazardly going from one place to the other because people want running water. They want basic services and they have to do it for themselves. I mean, that's wild to me that even as an interim, you know, while they're holding these whole neighborhoods in limbo, they won't let them make their own improvements, or they make it difficult from an operational standpoint. I don't know. How do you resolve that kind of problem? Who do you need to talk to allow these communities to thrive, even if their legal or planning status is in some kind of limbo? I don't know if you had any luck approaching the authorities about this. I'm interested in like what kind of advocacy you guys have done, in addition to just putting a spotlight on it and characterizing it in this way, which is obviously important. Have you worked with the authorities in Mumbai, for example, to try to make practices more humane while we figure out what the legal status should be of these neighborhoods?
So I think you're really, really hitting it on the nail, because this is really for us the meaning of the word, of the concept homegrown, is that there's an evolutionary property to those neighborhoods. They evolve all the time, so they are all about improvement, you know, and we're definitely not advocating for some kind of status quo. Nobody is, you know, nobody wants the reality to stay what it is now. Everybody is for an evolution towards an improvement. And we've been, of course, advocating for an understanding of this evolution, and for allowing people within those neighborhoods to kind of either improve it on their own at the very least, or even better, to have a government, municipal services that understand that they can actually support the efforts of the residents and come in and themselves, you know, find also solutions along with the residents to improve infrastructure, etc. In Mumbai, so we work in different contexts, right? We've been working in Mumbai for years. We're working also in Colombia. We're working in Europe, in Switzerland, in contexts which are really radically different in terms of, let's say the shape of cities on their history. In the case of Mumbai, we've been working for a very long time within Dharavi in a neighborhood called Koliwada, which is a fisherman village, where the community actually owns the land. And there we were able to work with the community on local improvement. And basically we apply this method, which is a method of incremental change and improvement, because, why does it work there? It's because it's actually a very pragmatic method. If you come and say, okay, now everyone, we're going to do a master plan and we're all going to be shifted into high-rise buildings, some people may want that, but the complexity of actually realizing this is so high, it's so difficult to do. And also it's so conflict ridden as a process that, to allow continuous incremental improvement is the most pragmatic approach, along with also being, you know, the most, let's say, conservative in terms of, you know, reducing the level of disturbance to people's life. So over there, we've been building, you know, over a dozen, you know, buildings and smaller structures, temples. We've been also rebuilding an old customs house, which was built by the British. We're now working on a park project. So there's plenty of things we can do, you know, with that approach and methodology. And I would say that also what's surprising is that this approach and methodology is something that very much works in contexts where you would expect it the least, you know, a context such as Europe and Switzerland. We've been also working on doing urban planning with people participation. And when you do participatory planning, the typology that often comes out as a result is it echoes very strongly the kind of homegrown typology as well. So that's another very interesting finding along our journey.
At the risk of sounding a little obtuse, but I am always interested in this too, is what lessons does the homegrown city offer, like, the sclerotic global north? Like, it's interesting. I'm here in Canada, and we're like, we have endless discussions about our housing crisis and the inability to build. Like, it's fascinating that we have this whole discussion that, you know, the United States is missing millions of housing units that it should have built. But meanwhile, of course, across much of the world, everyone is, of course, building their own future. I'm curious, are there any transferable lessons or how we could think about basically how to basically harness those techniques and energies and basically unleash it or unlock it, et cetera, your choice of verb in global North cities, full of regulation, full of zoning, et cetera, et cetera. You know, if you had to do an abundance policy agenda based on the homegrown city, what would it look like? Mm-hmm. Abundance and incredible scare quotes there for listeners. Just one.
Maybe I'll just start, Matthias, on this point, because it's really not only about the homegrown city, you know, in the sense that there is a narrative about homegrown capital, of homegrown processes, of, you know, of looking at the ability of, you know, users, residents, inhabitants of places as active agents. And, you know, if we have really created such a strong language of administrative passivity, you know, all over the world, because it's been top down, and the urbanism is the one of the biggest expressions of it. But it is there in terms of the way in which our financial institutions operate, is there in the way in which our educational institutions operate, is there in hospitals, the medical system. So the crisis is very deep in the way in which we have arranged finances. Sorry,
we literally had to invent a new word of placemaking, as if that's not exactly how almost all of urbanity exists. But we had
exactly,
to like
exactly.
It.
Yeah. So clearly, there is something, you know. We cannot even take the idea of the homegrown city outside the larger sort of flows of the way in which we look at administration and other services as well. And then it becomes important for us to understand that, you know, this is really quite deep. You know, it's something which, you know, asks us to be active at many fundamental levels, and which our institutions themselves are not really very ready for. I mean, whether it's from finance to banking to governance to education, none of these institutions actually allow for agency, because they have been arranged around the idea of encouraging passivity. It's there very strongly, even in our education systems, in many different ways. You know, like we may have little pockets of freedom, but by and large, the way in which our cultural capital is arranged, how much universities themselves are dependent on certain kinds of raising capital and speculation, how this feeds back into economic policy, and how those economic policies feed back into urban planning. These are really deep questions. So I would definitely say that we cannot only look at the city as a kind of a bracketed space outside these other larger problems. And that, but at the same time, having said that, for us, you know, the homegrown city is really a entry point of asking larger questions about governance as well, about you know, about finance and capital too. That, you know, that why is it that the systems have become more rigid at almost all sectors? And the one reason why people are frustrated that they cannot make those changes, they cannot fight outside regulations and zones, because they are tied to other things, you know. So even if someone wants to improve you know, a small component of infrastructure in the neighborhood. There are insurance companies which come into the picture. There are so many ways in which hands are tied. It's not only linked to ability and capacity. So this we really need to understand. And for us, the homegrown city is the starting point for us to understand many of these other questions as well.
I just want to add a bit to this. I mean, first of all, I think there's many, many different ways in which we could start answering your question. Along what Raul has said already, I would say that, you know, one of the most basic thing is allowing, and it's something that actually the West claims to be doing very well, but it's not doing so well in the realm of, let's say, urban development, is allowing initiative. And we see this happening in suburbs, you know, where people want to kind of change one thing or something, or maybe add something in their garden, in their houses, and the regulations are so heavy, it's so complicated, you know, that they actually prevented from doing this, you know. So the densification of the suburbs is already like a very good starting point there, you know, for like letting the homegrown happen. Then there's the reuse, you know, it's a big buzzword these days, but, you know, there's plenty of buildings, which may be office buildings or old warehouses. I mean, the city needs to be reused also more than built today, you know. So we know that there, it's not so necessarily the homegrown as much as the overgrown. We have old structures, we need to let these new uses happen. Then, you know, you mentioned reconnecting with places, you know, placemaking. I think there it really hits the idea of participation, participatory planning. And so we go from, let's say, individual initiative to collective initiatives. And that's another realm in which it's what's important is not just, you know, to create a space together, but it's also to create a community together in the process of creating space. And then the last thing I want to say, which I think is the most radical and important, is that ultimately, you know, what it really is about changing the planning process itself. And by this, I mean the way we've been projecting for, like, let's say, the past, you know, like 150 years in the West, which is always, I mean, I'm probably a bit beyond. It's, you know, we are in a situation A, and we want the situation, you know, like B or C to happen. And so we make a plan, and then we want to impose that plan upon a certain reality. And in the process of imposing this plan upon the existing reality, we're very destructive, because the only way we can actually manage to succeed in implementing the plan is by having a tunnel vision. And not understanding also what is actually happening in the process, you know. So we forget that actually, you know, there's an entire, let's say, context which is alive all around it, and that we should be aware of you know, all the kind of, like they say, the feedback loops, you know, that at some point in the 60s, people were thinking about, you know, urban planning in terms of systems and feedback loops and trying to, you know, bring complexity to the act of planning. But we've gone back to the most basic kind of form of, you know, planning and developing. And I think there are a total transformation allowing basically to, you know, to be much more grounded and to plan from within. Let places grow and evolve from the point of view of the users, but also of a local context, which is deeply embedded in, you know, in different systems. So I think, and it's not as complicated as I make it sound right now. I think it's in fact the most kind of natural way of moving ahead. This is what has been happening, you know, like everywhere. You know, forever, you know, before we started planning in a certain way, you know. Yeah. So I'm just saying there are great things about our capacity of projecting, but we should not be carried away by it, you know, and we should be very careful about also letting places emerge out of needs and context.
Yeah. And just, you know, and Europe, actually, a lot of examples exist in Europe. I've, you know, in the last few years, I have seen from the point of view of agencies, groups, youth groups, you know, collectives, sometimes even government policies, which encourage that. It's just that at the global level, these examples don't somehow enter into the space of formal urban planning and design because of other reasons, you know. Not because there's no willingness or there are no examples of that. Yeah.
I definitely think one of the most powerful images, and Greg alluded to this earlier, I didn't realize this was part of a series or this was something that Herbs has been doing for a while, is these photo montages. But I really like the one that superimposed a neighborhood in Tokyo on a neighborhood in Mumbai. One side of the street was Mumbai, one side was Tokyo, and it was really not clear which one was which. And people think of those as being such different places. Like, Japan is orderly, Japan is very controlled, India's chaotic, and nothing can get accomplished, and it's dirty, and then you see these two things side by side, and it's like, wow, it's really not that different. And it's like, what should be the role of government in these types of situations? You've got two parliamentary democracies with high population density cities. It should it just be a case of infrastructure first and let the populace do what they will with it? Because that sort of seems to be the formula that worked in Tokyo. I think the landholding issue is probably the key complexity there, that maybe you don't have such a powerful tool there for the individual plot owner in Mumbai. I'm not as well versed in that, but it does sort of seem like that's one of the key differences, is the decision by the government. And this, of course, was a provoked decision. It wasn't like they didn't try to control everything. I mean, after World War II, and they had tabula rasa, the city was absolutely destroyed. They did try to impose very top-down techniques on neighborhood organization. They wanted to do all the Corbusian towers in the park type thing. They just weren't successful. And it's almost more like the other analog I can think of going way, way back was that, after the London fire in the 1660s, Christopher Wren was deployed to try to put down a top-down plan, impose that on London, put some order on it, do Roman straight lines and everything. And that didn't work either. And it was because there was individual landholdings made it too complex. Is that the key there? I mean, or is there something else that is sort of, is it a generational thing? Like, I'm just trying to understand why, a place with so many similar characteristics has turned out so differently.
I mean, the Tokyo case is very particular and very interesting. It's true that there were a lot of excitement after World War II from some urban planners who thought they could do the same thing in Tokyo that they had done in Manchuria, and plan a city from the top down. But then there was no resources to do it. So the occupation government, the American government, said, okay, whatever money there is should be invested in infrastructure. And by this, they meant large-scale infrastructure, like, trains, and industry. And everything else would be left to, people within the neighborhoods to do, So this is what happened. Actually, what's so interesting, and then, of course, what happened is that the local government and the planning agencies, decided to kind of go with this and allow, not destroy what had been built incrementally by people who actually rebuilt their neighborhoods, but to retrofit infrastructure in smart ways. And there's been lots of intelligence, lots of effort put into how do we bring infrastructure into very dense neighborhoods? How do we fix it once it's already here? So the idea was, it's actually a very pragmatic idea. And this is what we really want to say very strongly also, is that the homegrown approach is not a romantic approach of preservation. It's a pragmatic approach of conservation and improvement, with limited capital. And this is exactly what happened. And a limited capital, but unlimited potential, creative potential for finding solutions which are adapted to specific situations. So this is, I think, the Tokyo model is teaching us this. In Mumbai, it's not any, it's not related to ownership patterns, because it's so easy to either give ownership to whoever is there or to create cooperatives. It's been done before. It's even been done in some pilot projects by the World Bank in Mumbai and other parts of India. So it's been done. It's not very complicated to do this. What really has prevented this from happening is a very dogmatic ideology of the city, how the city should look like, which was inherited from, let's say, the British colonial system, you know, and not accepting that, you know, this could be also part of, you know, let's say, the urban realm, you know. And so I think this is really about you know, dogmatism and ideology and what the city ought to look like. And I think this is why we need to really forcefully just say that it's okay, you know, other forms, other urban forms can exist. In fact, it makes the city more interesting.
Exactly. And just to add to the point where you talked about, you know, how two very different, but at the same time, similar democracies, working democracies, produce very different ways of looking at in generating conditions which are so extreme from each other. And you know, the fact is that in both cases, democracy in electoral terms does not always translate into democracy in institutional terms, in terms of local governances. And this is where the difference lies, you know, because in the case of Tokyo also, there has been it accompanied the growth of the middle class itself, the form and the growth of the middle class, they somehow grew together. In India, at a local level, especially in vulnerable neighborhoods, there was a much bigger socioeconomic divide, you know, and caste also plays a very big role in that, creating that divide. And it was very difficult for local institutional mechanisms of local democracy to actually work through all these different interests. And it was a much more difficult process. However, at the same time, the similarities are not, absent at all, or they're not superficial. They are actually very real, because, you know, having worked in both kinds of neighborhoods, in both cities, one did feel experientially so many elements. You know, it's about density, it's also about community. You know, the fact that there's economic energy which spills over. These are also very real things. And they go back to what you were talking about earlier, Daniel, in the context of Shanghai, you know, and Hawaii, that entrepreneurial energy which spills out of perhaps, you know, a broad, you know, if you want to call it an Asian relationship to public space, which is all about, vending, trading, coming out onto the streets. You can see that even in Asian neighborhoods, in other contexts, in Europe and the US also, that the nature, the texture of the neighborhood changes, largely because of the way the inside and the outside function. So there are all these elements which make us think about urbanism in different ways, and we feel that there's a lot to learn from each other. I mean, the fact is that perhaps Asian urbanism is much more comfortable with activities of trading and commerce, a lot more presence of flexible economic sort of activities, there is something, again, maybe as an anthropologist, I tend to see too much into cultural realms, but I do believe that they play an important role in the way in which the physical manifestations of neighborhoods also express themselves. So there is a bit of all these elements at work.
Yeah, that's true. I had not considered the very significant mantles of caste and colonialism in playing a different story in Mumbai and in India broadly. That is obviously very significant. Well, I'm delighted that you guys have been doing this for as long as you have. When did Urbs start working on this type of practice? It's been going for a while.
2008 is when we started, no, Matthias?
More or less. Yeah. I mean, it started as conversations, really, and then workshops, and, you know, little by little became a practice. But the office has been there in Dharavi for a very long time. And then it spread to other cities, first to Sao Paulo, no longer exists, but, you know, we were there for some time. In Bogota, it's still very much active. In Colombia, we also work in Cali now. And now for the past, 6-7 years or so in Geneva, Switzerland, and Paris more recently.
Well, it's been great to finally have you on Frozen here. I can't believe it took us until season 6 to finally do this, but it's a great occasion. And I do love it. I think my favorite part of our conversation was, you know, particularly describing the process and the communal planning, because it's always interesting to me when you see Starkitect firms decide they're going to like play around with this. And so, for example, I remember it was probably 15 years ago. I think it was Droch out of Amsterdam and Diller Scafidio and Renfro went to Levittown on Long Island and basically said, well, what if we pretended we were like going to make it more informal and people ran businesses out of their homes, et cetera, there. And to them, it was this sort of cute one-off exercise. It was very interesting because they just simply did not have any understanding of the larger processes under it. Imagining that happening in American suburbia is a stretch indeed. But
those processes are happening in American suburbia. They are happening in Europe. They are happening everywhere. You know, it's just that they're much more hidden. They don't really find an expression. Every local entrepreneur, every music band that records, you know, in the basement, all of that is part of this, creative energy, which is exists in neighborhoods. And sometimes it's just about letting it out a bit, you know, a bit more.
Well, I would say I had the good fortune of working with Jeannie Gang in 2012 for MoMA. Again, you guys, of course, were also part of your own MoMA exhibition with Uneven Growth. The one before that was foreclosed, where we went to Cicero, Illinois, which is, of course, mostly Hispanic as a suburb now of Chicago. Much of it is Mexican foreign born. And yeah, we basically came up and looking at the conditions there, tried to come up with a sort of set of local infrastructure to help all those entrepreneurs come out of their homes and create that. And we didn't have words for it at the time. And today we're like, oh, we created a co-working space and a co-living space. And now it's interesting to see the market take these kinds of forms and turn them into their own thing. So you're right. It is definitely happening there. I'll be curious to see how it catches up. So we'll have to have it back in another couple of seasons. Gentlemen, thank you, Rahul. Thank you, Matthias. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, Daniel.
Great. Thank you, Daniel. Yeah.